Welcome to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I chat with some of the world's top business influencers, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs in order to crack the code of networking. I believe that who you know is more important than what you know, and that your relationships ultimately determine the person that you become. So if you want to learn the new way of connecting, if you want to fill your network with quality people and skyrocket your results, then you're in the right place, because this is the Build Your Network podcast.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Build Your Network with Travis Chappell. My name is Eric Skrzynski, and I am Travis's producer, and I'm so excited that we are doing these compilation episodes again. On this episode, you're not going to hear from one, not two, you're going to hear from three different entrepreneurs giving their billion-dollar advice. First up, we're going to hear from Tillman Fertitta, who is the chairman and CEO of Landry's Incorporated and Golden Nugget Hotel and Casinos. He's a Houston Rockets owner, CNBC's billion-dollar buyer, and author. Next up, we're going to hear from Tom Bilyeu, a filmmaker and serial entrepreneur who founded Quest Nutrition with the goal of ending metabolic disease and adding value to people. Tom now helps solve the problem of poor mindset through his media studio, Impact Theory. His goal is to influence the cultural subconscious by creating content that empowers people. And last but not least, Travis sits down with Jeff Hoffman. Jeff is a successful entrepreneur, proven CEO, motivational speaker, and film producer. You're not going to want to miss one second of this episode. But first, if you understand the value of a podcast, but you don't have the time, the resources, or the team to get one started, then have our team create one for you with our Done For You podcast production service. Just visit travischappell.com/doneforyou and we'll see if you're a good fit for our Done For You podcast production service. All right, let's get into the episode.
What was it like for you transitioning it from being in high school into being a young adult? Like, talk to me about, you know, college, jobs, or your first restaurant that you started. What was that timeline in there?
Well, I mean, you get out of school, and I was even, you know, doing businesses while I was in school. And, you know, I did a little retail business, then I started building homes, and then I even did the direct selling business, which is really big today with like Shackley Vitamins, and won my first Cadillac at 21 years old. But what it gave you the ability to do is you learn how to speak in front of people, you learn how to approach people, you learn how to communicate, and at the same time, we're learning all the other business attributes of it. But I was doing homes. Then I hit the video game business right. That gave me a lot of cash flow. Then you start building little developments, and then I built my first hotel when I was 26 years old, which I still own today. Then the development world started falling apart when I was in my late 20s, and that's when you had all the S&L crisis and all the banks failed, and that's why banks are too big today. It really came out of Texas and the Southwest that they had to get other banks to acquire you. And that's when I had invested in a restaurant, and I knew the restaurant business because my dad had a single restaurant in Galveston, Texas, and I worked there and I totally understood it. And when you couldn't do any more development because the banks weren't lending money, my partners were all fighting and I was just an investor, and I bought them all out in 1986 and said, I'll build restaurants for a few years. And then at that point is when restaurant and chain restaurants became real hot. And that's when Outback and Cheesecake Factory and Brinker, which is Chili's, that's when all of these companies kind of developed, and including my company, Landry's. And I took the company public in 93. And all of a sudden you wake up one morning, you're worth $100 million. I owned 100% of it. And the rest is history. And I took it private in 10, but, you know, grew it from a $30 million revenue company in 92 to, a $2 billion revenue company when I took it private in 2010 over the next 17 years. And today I've grown it to a $4 billion revenue company.
What was your intention from the very beginning to grow the restaurant business that big, or was it just kind of taking it moment by moment and setting more and more goals?
You always take everything moment by moment and continue to set goals and be very opportunistic. And I would say the biggest thing about being an entrepreneur is being very opportunistic. And I think that's what I've done probably better than most.
Got it. So I'm curious to know about your transition from, you know, your first restaurant into your second one. And was that more difficult of a transition to go from, you know, one to two to three than it was to go from, you know, 50 to 60 to 70?
Oh, no, it's easy, you know, to go from 50 to 60 to 70. Matter of fact, I had one, then I had a second one, then three and four never hit the way I wanted. So let's just call those failures. And then I had a great run of number 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, something like that. So, you know, there's a paddle for everybody's ass, and I could have easily quit then, but I felt like I learned from my mistakes and, you know, just kept plowing ahead.
So after building a restaurant empire, really, I mean, you on paper are the world's richest restaurateur, right? So after building this whole empire, where along the line did the desire and commitment to purchase the Houston Rockets come in?
You know, it all happened. You know, I was a big fan of the Rockets, you know, all through this time. I was a minority partner in the 80s. The first time I made money, I was a little bit involved. And, you know, it's kind of like the old big box theory. You know, if you're going to go open up 50 restaurants, you got to go find 50 general managers. And those 50 restaurants are maybe going to do $25 million in EBITDA. And if you go do a casino, you only have to find one general manager and it makes $50 million. So you go to the big box theory what gave me the opportunity to buy the Rockets and pay more than anybody else had ever paid for a sports franchise in America, you know, was the fact that I owned 100% of my company. It's probably if not the largest single shareholder company in America, it's easily in the top two or three, but everybody seems to have one partner and I don't have any. So I was able to go to my lenders and take a big dividend out of the company, because when you buy a professional sports team, you can only borrow a couple hundred million dollars on the team, a few hundred million. And so you need to come up with that other, if you're paying $2 billion, you better find a way to come up with that other $1.7 billion. And yeah. I had enough equity in my company and it was strong enough that I could take out, you know, a pretty good sized dividend besides the capital and equity that I already had.
How much did that purchase mean to you? I mean, growing up in Galveston, I'm a Houston local, right? So obviously you were a fan, like you just said, for a lot longer than you've been the owner. So was it ever on your mind that you might possibly end up buying a different NBA team, or would you have even considered buying a different NBA team? Or was it just like, I'm such a Rockets fan, it has to be the Rockets?
No, believe it or not, I looked at other teams, but I knew the owner well. I sat next to him. And I just didn't have a desire to own a team in another market. And of the 94 professional major sports teams, football, basketball, baseball, I'm not going to throw hockey into this, even though it's definitely a major sport. Very few people get to own a team in their hometown because it's just wrong timing or whatever. So to own the Rockets in your hometown is just a great honor. And you're held very accountable owning a team in your own town, and it's very exciting, and it's something that is a great dream come true. Yeah. If there was anything on my bucket list that I always said I wanted to do, from hosting many presidents in my home to, you know, ringing the New York Stock Exchange before I was 40, but being in the Texas Business Hall of Fame before I was 40, and then getting on the Forbes 400 and moving up to the 150 range today, I would have said the only thing that I really didn't accomplish business-wise is that I never got to own a professional sports team. So my dream got to come true.
Yeah, that's the big thing. I've been a basketball fan and player my whole life, and that right there is the dream right there, like the dream business to own one.
Absolutely. But, you know, let me tell you something that's kind of interesting is 25 years ago, I was a minority partner and I bid on the team and I lost out on it. And it was an $80 million purchase price that I was doing with some other individuals. And, you know, it's kind of funny and you can't look back. And so here, 25 years later, I'm able to buy the team, but instead of paying $80 million, I paid $2.2 billion. But you know what? But then maybe I don't, chances are though, I don't grow a company that's worth billions of dollars. And so, cause I'm focused on the rockets. So, you know, the timing wasn't right then, but, you know, I probably don't accomplish everything else I accomplish in my entrepreneurial life if that doesn't happen.
Right. Right. Yeah. Everything happens for a reason at some point along the road, for sure. So coming into this season, Tillman, this is just this taking all business aside. Okay. This is a selfish question that I'm asking because I'm a basketball fan. Okay. How confident are you going into this season with the team that you guys have put together now?
You know, we felt really confident the last 2 years, and I think it's kind of a fact that, you know, this is what I say. You got to build a team where you hope you're one of the top three or four teams, and then you need luck, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it is. And, you know, let's be honest, okay? In the last few years, Golden State has been lucky in the sense that they didn't have the injuries and the other teams did. Mm-hmm. It was like us losing Chris Paul for the sixth and seventh game 2 years ago.
Right.
Well, this year it went the other way. You know, their players got hurt and Toronto's didn't. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you could say, oh, well, this was absolutely the best team, Toronto. But you know what? You get to be one of the top three, four, five best teams, and then you need a little luck. Well, I think what we've done this year with Russell, we're going to be one of the top three or four best teams in the league. And now we need a little luck. So. Yeah. I'd like to be lucky and good.
The weird thing about being 22 is you feel at 22 the way you feel at 42, which is I'm as old as I'm ever going to be. My whole life has led me to this moment. This is the sum total of my life. You don't feel like, when I think of a 22-year-old now, I think they're a kid. Like, oh my God, your brain hasn't even finished developing yet. So, but you don't feel like that when you're in it. So it felt like my entire life was geared towards filmmaking. I believe at that time that you're either good at something or you're not. That, you know, I thought of filmmaking the way most people think of singing. You either have it or you don't. It's not something you really teach. Like, sure, you could help somebody with the technicalities and stuff like that, but you either can sing or you can't. And so
you can get like a little bit better.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought, I went into film school thinking, I'm really good at this. Mm-hmm. This is like what I'm meant to do. And then my senior thesis shows me the truth, which is that I had no talent. And so that was very hard to swallow. At first, it was an absolute slide towards depression. I didn't know where I was going to go with my life. Everything that was so clear, now I felt hopelessly lost. When you're in film school, especially USC, you feel connected to the film world. I remember standing one time, maybe even closer than you and I are to George Lucas, and for like 30 minutes. And I just thought, like you're here. You, it just feels like, even though you don't quite know how it's going to happen, you feel like it's going to happen.
Right.
I'm proximity. I've got the talent. And then I graduate. I have no more proximity. And I went out on a note where I'm like, I have no talent. So edging towards depression. I'm dirt poor at the time.
Move like back into your parents' place.
No. I stayed here in LA.
Okay.
And I'm living in an apartment complex. I can't really afford furniture. I mean, to really drag this out, I was living with another guy. He's like, can my girlfriend come and stay with us for a week? That turned into 2 years. And then finally I moved out because you're getting outvoted. And so you're just like, this is a nightmare. So I find myself in this really dingy part of town, living by myself for the first time, can't afford furniture. And I would just come home from work and lay face down on the floor. And it was a period in my life I was the king of remedial jobs. Mm-hmm. And I would intentionally seek out jobs where I knew I'd be smarter than the person interviewing because my self-esteem was so fragile. I needed to be pumped up where the person interviewing would be like, you're too smart for this. What are you doing here? Right. And I lived for that moment. So I had like a string of really dumb jobs, including selling video games retail. So I was just the guy behind the counter. I had a degree in filmmaking, but I'm the guy behind the counter when you come to buy used video games.
Yeah.
Literally. And that was my existence, really, really dark time in my life. And at this point, I begin to realize, this doesn't end anywhere good. Right. And in college, I'd really become a voracious reader. And so I start reading about the brain. Okay. And as I'm reading about it, it was right, this is the late 90s, there's this hotly debated issue about brain plasticity. And now people just, yeah, the brain's plastic, you can create new neurons. Till the day you die, you can learn new stuff, all that. But back then, some people were saying it was real, other people were saying that it was totally fake.
And, the theory at that point. Like
that by the time you're like 12, you're like pruning neurons and you know you're never going to become great at something unless you showed a natural predilection for it. Hmm. So I'm like, I choose to believe that the people that say that you can learn new things are right, even though nobody's sure. Because if they're right, then I have hope for my future. And if they're wrong, I literally don't know what to do with my life. Yeah. And that was like too scary to face. So I found my way into personal development out of desperation. I didn't want to become depressed. And so I start getting into like Tony Robbins.
I'm sorry to interrupt that, but I really want to touch on this because I find that it's something that gets brought up a lot in all these interviews is that there was a really big low point that brought on this necessity to jump into personal development and make yourself better and like face your demons. Do you think that the enemy of rising to your potential is then mediocrity? Because I feel like if you are not in that point, I don't see as many people making the decision when things are just kind of comfortable to jump into personal development and like really reach their goals.
Yeah, I think that mediocrity is the thing people have to fear, not failure. And most people spend their time being afraid of failure, but failure is the most information-rich data stream you will ever encounter. Like in the failure, if you're willing to look at it, you're going to be like, oh, I see what we did wrong. I see how things, you know, came undone. I can learn from that and I can do better next time. But when it is that you just aren't doing anything, then the way that days blend into months, blend into years, like there's just this numbness to things. Mm. And people get caught in that. And all of a sudden it's 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50. And then they're just like, there's nothing I can do. It's already passed. It's who I am. And that scares the life out of me.
Yeah. The regret, right?
I don't even think about it as regret. I just think about it as like doing cool shit and pushing yourself allows you to feel something neurochemically that's awesome. And you just missed out on a lot of years of that because you got in that numbness of the routine. Hmm. And I imagine most of those people will have regret on their deathbeds, but man, it's the day to day that scares me. It's like the day to day, just the missed opportunity of you could have felt rad about yourself and yet you're stewing in this like, the thing that really worries me, if it were just that people, everything is sort of okay, I could actually like, whatever, that's not a big deal. Maybe you just wanted a stress-free life. It's that people's tolerance for not okay is pretty horrendous. And the depths to which some people will go before they force themselves to make a change and start doing hard things is pretty scary.
Yeah.
And so when I think about doing the hard things, which most people aren't prepared to do, it's like, you've really got to train yourself to do that, to break out of this stuff. Even though one day they'll look back on it and say, that's actually pretty easy, it feels hard because you have to face your inadequacies.
Got it. So going back to the story, you start reading a bunch of books about the brain and find out that humans are the ultimate adaptation machine, like something that you always say. So then what was the next step from there, jumping into this career at this software company?
Well, that was me really wanting to control the art. So by that point, I'm reading about brain plasticity. I've chosen to believe that it's real. I start teaching. And as I'm teaching film, I realize I can help them make their films better. Now I'm having to work my ass off. And if you've ever taught, like teaching is crazy. I don't understand how it's not one of the highest paid professions. The amount of work you have to do outside of the class is crazy.
Right.
So I was teaching during the day and then basically researching and trying to put lesson plans and not wanting to embarrass myself the next day because I was like, I'm the guy that failed at my senior thesis. So it's not like I have this figured out. So at night I'm like going crazy and I'm really starting to understand what my teachers were trying to teach me. I was starting to understand where I went wrong with my film. Like it was all starting to come together. And then I would tell them what I'm learning and their films would get better. And so I'm like, okay, hold on. If I can help them make their films better, I could help me make my films better. So that like is hanging above my head in a thought bubble. And these two successful entrepreneurs come across my path and they say, look, man, you're coming to the world with your hand out. If you want to control the art, you're going to have to control the resources. Mm. So come with us and get rich. And I thought, that sounds amazing.
How did you meet them?
So they saw me giving a talk about film and media and how it can influence people.
So obviously made enough impression on them for them to come to you and say, hey, come work with us?
Correct. So they were like, we need a copywriter. Seemed like you'd be good at that. So why don't you come and join us? So I did that. And they said, but don't think of yourself as a copywriter. You can have any position in the company you want. So we are always looking for partners and we settle for employees. I thought, whoa, that's so cool. So I saw them make that offer to dozens of people and nobody was ever, like, they couldn't see it through. Like, some people would sort of move like they were doing it, right. But like when it got hard, they wouldn't. And I went all the way in.
And so at this point, the end goal is the money, right?
1,000%.
So the money was going to fund what is kind of created now, which...
I did not, unfortunately, have this vision.
Okay.
I just wanted to make movies.
Okay.
So it was, I wanted to make any cool story, whatever. I didn't have a big why. And so all I thought about every day was getting rich, getting rich, getting rich. That was it. I want to get rich. I told my wife, I'm going to make you rich. Like that was, yeah. I was literally focused on dollars and cents. I can't tell you how many times I would take a calculator out while waiting for a movie to start and be like, all right, if I became partner and I got this percentage and we sold for this much, you know, like how much money would we have? And my wife and I used to do that over and over and over.
I'm curious, was it difficult to frame your mindset to allow yourself to say, I want to get rich coming from like a lower middle class household?
Definitely not. Okay. Growing up in the 80s, man, and this is something where I really disconnect with people now who are like, the accumulation of wealth is evil and all stuff. Yeah. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, it is a powerful resource, but it's just a resource. Like, you can do dumb shit with it. You can do things that are bad. You can do things that are ugly, but you can also do things that are insanely beautiful.
Right.
And when you, the fascinating thing to me about like charity is people really get excited about the charity, but what they don't realize is they're just spending dollars that were made in something that they say they hate.
Right.
So it's like, well, it's not the generation of the money, it's what's being done with the money that people have beef with. Fair enough. And I think that really that's, we're moving into a new era where it matters what you do with your money.
Yeah. There's almost like this culture of like wealth shaming. Where it's like, oh, you drive a nice car, must mean that you're a dick.
Yes.
You
know,
it's
like, and that will hold people back. Like, they're going to struggle financially because they have this weird fucking story about money. And so that actually worries me, not for myself, because if you can deliver value, you can always make money. But I worry for people who have an ugly story about money, so they're never going to pursue getting out of that terrifying place of living paycheck to paycheck, never being able to amass enough money. Just be comfortable. I'm not saying people have to want to be a millionaire. But good Lord, like having 6 months cash on hand, like trying to work up in your company or taking, you know, less upfront pay so that you can get equity. Like there's so many things that you can do, but you have to have a story about money's beautiful. Money is this thing that facilitates and I have a beautiful dream and I need the money to facilitate that.
Right.
So impact theory being certainly in my life, the example, right? I want to pull people out of the matrix by giving them an empowering mindset. The only reason I'm able to do this is because I generated so much wealth. So it's like, and we've now touched so many people's lives. I'm talking people like grabbing me, crying, like I was going through a divorce. You're the only thing that got me through. There was this one guy grabbed me, yoked. The kind of guy you would just think, good looking dude, young, ripped. And he pulls me aside and he's like trying to be real quiet. And he just starts crying. And he's like, I want to commit suicide, dude. And I don't know the way out of it. So it's like the fact that the content is like helping him and helping him process. And you just think, fuck, like this is why money is so powerful, because it allows you, if you have a beautiful dream, it allows you to build something beautiful.
I do see a lot of people that say, hey, I want to be an entrepreneur, and they have no problem to solve. They just want to be an entrepreneur. That doesn't work. It works when there's something in the world that's driving you nuts and you got to fix it.
So was this first company, was that kind of the segue into Priceline? How did that come about?
No, Priceline didn't exist then for several. For me, I was involved in several more startups before we ever got to that one. But for my personal journey, that is definitely what got me interested in the travel industry. Because when we started digging in the back of the travel industry, right, to solve this problem, we started seeing all the inefficiency in the industry and saying, man, this industry could definitely be streamlined and take the fat out of the middle and take the cost out of the middle. So that is what working on the ticket printers in the first place is what got me interested in trying to make, you know, one of the world's biggest global industries, travel, more efficient.
Yeah. So what was the timeline here? So how old were you about when you were doing the kiosk thing? How long did it take you to transition into creating Priceline? And would you say that Priceline is like one of the more successful ventures that you've had?
Yeah. So I was in my 20s when I was doing that. I had an engineering, a corporate job, and I hated it. I was an engineer at a big engineering company. And again, a DNA thing. I just couldn't work in that infrastructure and bureaucracy in the case of the company I worked for. So I was only in my 20s and I quit. And when I started that first startup, and we were very lucky that the company was acquired 3 years later. We sold it. And so I continued to work on some other startup ideas, some that worked and some that didn't along the way. Before, like, for example, we got this crazy idea that you don't have to go to the mall to buy a sweater. You have a computer at home. You could buy one on this new thing called the internet. That idea failed because we built an internet shopping site way before anyone knew what the internet was. That transition, that failure into another startup I did, which was internet banking. And we created some of the first internet banking technology, and that one was successful. We had banks all over the US, Europe, and South America using the product, and we sold that company. And then there was basically an inventor, a guy named Jay Walker up in Connecticut. And Jay is the one that had the intellectual property of a reverse auction, the concept of bidding on unsold inventory, naming your price. That was Jay's patent and Jay's idea. So Jay is the one that started calling a team of people, and he's the one who assembled a team to go build Priceline. But the timing was perfect, because at the beginning, when we all got to Priceline, the internet was brand new, but now people were starting to feel comfortable using it.
Right.
And travel was still this inefficient industry that could be disintermediated using the internet. So it was a good idea, but it was also the right place at the right time. And it was just a really fun ride.
Yeah, yeah. And so what's your involvement with all of that stuff now?
Really none, because we had companies. I've been involved in companies. You know, later I did another internet company called Ubid.com that I was the CEO of. That was like the fifth largest auction site on the internet. But we've had a combination, some that didn't work, companies that we sold and companies we took public. And about 5 years ago is when I made a commitment to giving back. So I left all my companies then and said, I'm going to spend some years of my life giving back for the blessings I've received from the field of entrepreneurship by mentoring entrepreneurs. So I've been on like a 5-year world tour of mentoring the last 5 years and just trying to help other people start their companies and achieve their dreams. So I'm not involved in any of those companies at this point.
Really cool. So now you're doing a lot more travel. We kind of talked about this a little bit off recording as well. What's one of your favorite places to travel to, Jeff?
Well, I tell you what, I think, you know, one of my childhood goals was before I die, for my life to have been well lived, I decided this, that I want to visit 50 countries in my lifetime. by the way, part of that, Travis, came from this, like in seventh grade, we had to read a Mark Twain book.
Uh-huh.
And on the inside cover of the Mark Twain book, Mark Twain put a quote. His quote was, I'm going to paraphrase it, but his quote was that travel is the fatal enemy of prejudice. And I was like, wow, my teacher said, you know, Jeff, what does that mean? And I said, it means that the more we get out, the more of the world we see, and the more time we spend with people who don't look like this, like us, the more tolerant and understanding of human beings we'd be, more love, less hate. And she said, you're right. And I said, man, I want to go see the world now. So my goal was to visit 50 countries, and I've been to about maybe 92, I think, that I'm up to.
Wow.
Different countries I love for different reasons, but if I had to pick, to answer your question, it's probably a combination of Australia and New Zealand.
Yes.
That you and I have talked about before.
I love
the people. Yeah. I love the nature. I love the sunshine. I love the animals. When I'm in, and I just recently was in both Australia and New Zealand, and you know, one afternoon after working with entrepreneurs for a couple of days, I took the day off and I was out feeding kangaroos in a field in Australia. And then that weekend I was visiting the Maori Indians on their property and learning about their history down in New Zealand. I love being down there.
Yeah. And that, you have a really cool story too about visiting that Indian reservation. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there are parts of it that if you're not Maori, you can't go on their land, but they were just one of the Maoris came to me and he said, we'd like to thank you for the time you're giving to our people here in New Zealand, helping people help themselves. We'd like to do something for you in return and teach you a little bit about our culture and our history. And we went out of Auckland, out of New Zealand, to where the Maori basically reservation, where their property is, but it's gated and you can't walk on that property if you're not a Maori. And so I thought that was the end of it. And he said, look, we're going to give you a special thing. We're going to basically welcome you into the tribe, which is a formal ceremony where they do a series of chants, a little bit of a dance, and then it ends with the Maori warrior doing a nose rubbing thing. So he and I rubbed noses to formally welcome me in. And then I was able to go on the property and learn their history. And it was one of my favorite visits in the entire world.
Man, that's literally when you were telling me that story earlier, I was like, man, I just added something to my bucket list. get well, accepted into an Indian tribe. Like that's now on my bucket list.
That's a really cool one. And I appreciated the opportunity and I learned so much about the culture as a result.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want more advanced networking strategies as well as an instant network upgrade, then consider partnering with my BYN Inner Circle Mastermind. There are already dozens of high-quality entrepreneurs in the group. There's dozens of video lessons on networking. There's monthly calls. There's accountability crews and more, all for the low investment of just $99 a month. So head over to BYNInnerCircle.com to jump in. That's BYNInnerCircle.com. Thanks so much for joining us on today's show. We'll see you next time. Remember to leave every relationship better than you found it.